Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, and this morning's conversation is with Michael Jackson. Michael's the Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Department of Transportation, and joining us on our conversation is Dave Abel. Well, Michael, earlier in the last segment, you were talking about your day on 9/11, and we kind of ended in the evening, and so I'm sort of curious, as you all gathered together, like, what happened?
Well, Secretary Mineta brought his team together, Paul, to inventory the things that we needed to do and the things that we knew, the things that we didn't know, and make assignments about how to proceed. That took a fair bit of time. We met with airline officials by telephones to assess on an hour-by-hour basis what was happening and how we would get the system back up. We'd never turned it off, and now we had aircraft scattered from Canada to bases in the Midwest that nobody had ever expected to land at. So that planning began in earnest that afternoon and evening. But I do remember one story, which I'll share with you, when the secretary got back to his office after the meetings, and I was in there with him for a little bit. We came to identify something that we called the pizza parlor dilemma. And at that time, we were standing by his windows and saw the metallic glow of the Pentagon still on fire, with the smoke looking out of his windows still drifting across National Airport, now closed and darkened. And the pizza parlor problem for us was taken from a tragic event which now has become insanely all too common in the Mideast. A guy strapped a bomb to himself and went into a pizza parlor in Israel, blew up the pizza parlor, and blew up men, women, and children along with it. And so the question is, how do you manage that type of world? How do you manage security in that type of world? And what it comes down to is not a question of eliminating vulnerabilities, but managing vulnerabilities. You balance openness and the need to move people and goods through our system with the mandate, the necessity to improve security. And it is always a balancing act. Do you close all pizza parlors, or do you close all airports? Do you hand search every individual coming into a restaurant or to an airport? There are ways to make the security equation go much higher up the comfort scale. But in doing so, we lose fundamental mobility and freedoms, which are things to balance and treasure. So that dilemma, we concluded that night, would be with us for the duration of our time as stewards at the department with our management team. And that has proved to be vibrantly true.
One of the more immediate challenges after this was to open the airports, because they were closed and people were clamoring to deal with. What were the issues surrounding that, and how did that decision work its way out?
Well, there were many, many things that we didn't know that day, that night, the next morning, about whether or not terrorists might be planning to attack in a second wave, who was on flights that were stopped before they reached their final destination. Were those individuals going to be back on the plane the next day and taking an attack to the cockpit once again? So we had to assess all of the security measures that we could put in place at airports to evaluate who was getting on airplanes and how we were going to keep them safe. We put in place a slew of temporary rules, some of which became permanent, many of which became permanent, about how to screen people, what was allowed on airplanes, what we would do to try to diminish the risk, find that balancing point. Some things were terrifically insightful from our team that pulled together first. Some were terrifically stupid. And in fact, later we ended up with an exercise which we called the stupid rule exercise, which was to go back and take off the shelf things that we had done at the beginning with imperfect knowledge. And so I think it's this constant reassessment and balancing that began that night to find that dilemma of the balance and how to manage it going forward.
Now, when dealing with that that dilemma, there needs to be a balance between what you can do through policy and what you can do through the behaviors of individuals in the field. In the things that you've done in TSA, how have you balanced out the responsibility and the authority of the people who are doing the screening versus what's set centrally in the policies that are developed to be able to protect us against our vulnerabilities?
Dave, it's a good question, a hard balancing act, and a difficult one to answer in many ways. We ran at it from different angles. We had to have a very centralized agenda of how to roll out what would become a screening workforce of some roughly 60,000 individuals. We created a new federal air marshal program from scratch, basically. We had 32 air marshals on September 11th. Today, we have many thousands of air marshals. So we had to be able to manage that centrally to make it happen and work. And at the same time, we had to have a decentralized empowerment for the local airport security forces to be able to do their jobs. One of the early things we did is we went out and hired a very successful private sector headhunting firm to help us recruit the top 100 or so security directors at the major airports. And we found phenomenal people stepping up all across America. Ike Richardson in Chicago, who had been an aircraft carrier commander, a major city police chief that took over in Hartsfield, career FBI agents, career law enforcement people, career security people, stepping up to do a job that was going to be full of hassles and lots of challenges, but was just vitally important. So we recruited this team of really good people. We tried to train them and equip them with skills, and at the end of the day, we're gonna rely on their discretion a lot to manage things on a day-to-day basis.
So you've mentioned the work that you did both between public and private sector, and you've mentioned the work that you did as far as being able to bring on some key leadership. What was necessary to establish a culture and a management culture that had the ability to be able to succeed when public consensus was that there was no way that the organization could achieve what had been prescribed in the law? Somehow you managed to. What were the cultural aspects that allowed you to do that?
Well, we sort of hung a metaphorical sign on everybody's forehead that said bureaucratic thinking not allowed. And we challenged people to be nimble and innovative in looking at how to do things. We had radically different and more aggressive procurement tools that we used. Congress gave us that tool. We used it fully. But we put a focus on trying to think through to the bottom of how you do things. And then it's, again, this story without sounding corny. Of all around America, people stepped up to the plate. This is not about some one man or woman figured out how to do all this. It was how you created this culture. At the beginning, we looked to the Coast Guard that has this phenomenal group of men and women that go in harm's way every day and was a central part of the department, and said to them, how do we import your culture? So we imported some of their people, and we talked about culture and how you build and train and retrain and test and measure success and performance. And then all around the country, people just bellied up to the bar and came to do this. Can I tell you a little story about Melanie McCann?
Please.
After several months of building this new organization, we started to hire people who would train security screening trainers around the country. We got 600 of them in Oklahoma, recruited them very carefully, trained them very carefully, and then sent them around to be the cornerstone of the training teams we put in place around the country. Deputy secretaries run around, do a lot of things. I was going around giving a grant one day in April of 2002 as we had just begun this process, and got on a little regional jet to come home, and somebody was sitting in my seat. I said, excuse me, ma'am, you know, I went to the back of the plane, row 13, last row, and said, you're in my seat, you're in, you know, I'm in 13A, and she was in 13B, as it turns out. So as things happened on the airplane, we got to talking. I initially, somewhat reluctantly, you know, she was going to Virginia. I was, too. She was going because she had a new job. I said, that was great. She was a little nervous about flying. I said, I wasn't. And and then she said, yeah, I got a new job. I'm working for the Transportation Security Administration. I dropped my books. I looked at her. I said, no kidding. This is the first one I'd ever met that wasn't in my office. And this was a wonderful story. She told me about why she signed up and what she did. And she said, I wanted to be a Marine. And she had a little physical disability that prevented her from doing that. She didn't graduate from high school, went and got a GED. She was raising a couple of kids by herself, working very hard. And she said, you know, Mr. Jackson, it's really tough in these airports. People get grumpy. And she says, when I feel like I'm about to get grumpy, I just sort of turn around and I look down that concourse and I see people walking away from my screening checkpoint. And I say to myself, if I do my job right, that man or that woman's going to get home to their son or their daughter or their mother or their spouse tonight. And she says, I feel really great about doing that. Well, you know, guys, I could have flown home that night without the airplane. I felt so good about what Melanie McCann represented and what we were attracting into this new organization. And I've been around the country to airports, small and large, and they're chock full of people like Melanie.
It's a good stopping point. Rejoin us in a few minutes as we continue our conversation with Michael Jackson. This is the Business of Government Hour.
How can public-private partnerships in education, specifically e-learning, create new opportunities for African education? Authors Norman LaRocque and Michael Latham, in their Endema report, The Promise of E-Learning in Africa, The Potential for Public-Private Partnerships, discuss the emergence of new technology and new models of public-private partnerships that make e-learning a viable tool for addressing education access inequality in Africa. According to the report, adopting e-learning in Africa will increase education access and quality, as well as lower education costs. However, partnerships with the private sector are needed to bring e-learning to Africa in a systematic and cost-effective way. For a copy of this report and other endowment reports, visit our website at www.businessofgovernment.org or call us at 703-741-1077.